Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The image of the typical college student is someone between the ages of 18 and 23, single and childless, kind of footloose and fancy free. But a new report from the United States Government Accountability says, Office of Government Accountability Office says that one in five college students are parents. Many work full-time jobs while enrolled in classes. Many are the first in the family to attend college, and increasing numbers are military veterans. How they seek help to manage all of that depends on where they live and where they attend school. Yolanda Zepeda is Assistant Vice Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at Ohio State. She oversees a range of programs that promote the academic success of students from diverse backgrounds. Welcome.
Thank you, Ann. It's nice to be here.
How have the demographics of college students changed at Ohio State?
So Ohio State is a land-grant institution, and we have a mission to serve broadly the residents of Ohio. And as demographics have changed nationally, we've also seen a shift, increasing number of first-generation college students. And actually, we have made a very high commitment to address access and affordability of college attendance for our students. So that means we are making college Ohio State accessible to more students who economically might have been priced out otherwise. So when we talk about first-generation college students, we are talking about a very diverse group of students. We have many students from the Appalachian area that are coming from settings that are quite different from students that are coming from the inner cities, the urban centers of Ohio. And then, of course, returning students and student parents are all in the mix.
And the population is aging, right?
Absolutely. The just structurally, looking at the Ohio population overall, if you look at the numbers of students who are graduating from high school and then that we are going to draw upon for our colleges, those numbers are just shrinking. And if you look at underrepresented minority groups that have not historically participated in high rates in Ohio colleges, those groups are actually expanding. Latino, especially, is a very young population, and the numbers in our high schools are growing.
What does the stereotype of a typical student do to the psyche of a non-traditional student?
Well, it's not only the stereotype. So yes, there are stereotypes that students are coming from affluent, more privileged backgrounds where financial concerns are not an issue, fitting in. All of those concerns are typically not viewed as an issue for traditional students. But while I would say all of our students are coming with new kinds of needs and challenges, non-traditional students are seeing in our practices and policies a lot of messaging that says this is not for you. For example, for undergraduate students, we require first and second year students to live on campus. Mm-hmm. And our campus dorms are not designed for families. So that sends a strong message about who we expect to serve.
By the way, not cheap.
Absolutely. That's right. When you look at the cost of campus housing and the meal plans, they are not inexpensive. And so we need to be really intentional throughout. When we look at the way we structured the classes and making accessible childcare available, the scheduling of exams, they're in basically every aspect of university life, there are messages that signal who is welcome and who these opportunities are structured for and who they're not. And so it's really incumbent on all of us to examine everything that we do and ask ourselves, are we putting undue barriers on students who don't fit the traditional profile of students we've served in the past?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the non-traditional student today and how, you know, government agencies, how universities and colleges are responding to that changing demographic. My guest is Yolanda Zepeda. She is the Assistant Vice Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at Ohio State. If you're a non-traditional student, if you're someone who went to school, maybe you're the first generation, maybe you are a parent, maybe you're married with a family, maybe you're returning in your 40s, maybe even your 50s or whatever it might be. You don't fit that 18 to 23-year-old demographic. Give us a call. Tell us what your story's been. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So that messaging that you were talking about, Yolanda, it's sending conflicting messages about whether you're welcome or not. And does it change behavior? Does it make people not, do you know if it makes people then not even try or have a hard time adapting?
That's right. So one question is accessibility, just being able to access the university and access the services and resources that we have available. So if they're not structured in a way that they are, that non-traditional students can reach them or use them, take advantage of those services, then that message is it's not for you. And it's not intentional, but we have to, again, examine and question everything we do. Also, what kinds of supports do we make available to students? And I'll talk a little bit in a bit about our Access Collaborative program that's focused on students with children. But more generally, we're seeing more students who are coming with housing insecurity, whether they have families or whether they're single persons. And so we need to make sure that we're ready to respond to those needs and help students find the resources they need. And also put messaging out there that you're not alone, that we know that there are students who are struggling with this.
And if there's housing insecurity, they're often food insecurity.
Food insecure, yeah. Exactly. And we do have a campus-based food pantry, and we're trying to remove the stigma that's associated with using those services. But the big challenge is making sure everyone on campus is aware of the array of services that we offer. I think also all of our students are asking for more counseling and psychological support. And I think non-traditional students have some added challenges in this regard. And so we need to make sure that we are structuring services to be accessible and responsive to the particular needs of those students. In the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, for example, we have a resident psychologist. He's he's an employee of our counseling center, but he is on site in our building, so he gets to know our students and becomes really familiar with their needs, and they also get to know him and trust him.
It's a big university, though. How does one person manage that?
Right. That's why you're absolutely right. What we need to do is make sure that all bases where students are orienting their campus life are aware of the array of services and are also thinking creatively about how they're both becoming aware of the needs of their students and responding to those needs.
And I wonder if there's also a disconnect between students who don't live on campus, never lived on campus, because they didn't have to, because they live close enough to the university that they got the they were exempt from that, from having to do that. If they feel like all of these services and this array of services, when they're heading straight to environmental sciences or straight to chemistry every day, do they feel and get the same kind of orientation to all of that?
Right. I think that is a challenge for us right now. We're experiencing one very concrete example. We have a U.S. Department of Education grant. It's Child Care Means Access. It's See Campus.
Okay.
And in any case, the grant provides resources for child care.
Mm-hmm.
And the traditional ways that we identify and find the students is through student organizations and students who are engaged in our various programs. We send emails out to student groups and work those channels to promote our services. But if you can imagine for students with children, as you suggest, they live very busy lives. They're balancing childcare, work responsibilities, their school responsibilities. They're racing into campus, attending their class, and then they may leave to go pick up a child or get to a job. So they're not students that are necessarily hanging on social media. They're not necessarily being engaged in student organizations. And so that is a group that because we haven't served them intentionally in the past as a university, it's really hard for us to find them. And so for anyone listening, I ask you to reach out to any students with children that you know and anyone at Ohio State and let them know that the Office of Diversity and Inclusion has some support services for them.
And getting back to the messaging issue, if I open up anything from Ohio State, because my kid went there, all the pictures show young, beautiful 18 to 23-year-olds lounging around on campus, studying in, you know, at the library, that kind of a thing. You don't see pictures of people.
That's right. And so that those are conversations that we are having with our colleagues, again, across the campus. If you go to the Office of Diversity and Inclusion and look at some of our photos, you will see students with parents and you'll see some of our programming. But all of us need to question the messaging that we're putting out. If we have to say it, we have to show it, and then we have to structure what we do to make sure that we mean it.
OSU just announced that it's closing its married housing, I guess is what it's traditionally been called, Buckeye Village.
Buckeye.
What is the basis for that policy change, and how does it reflect or not what we've been talking about?
So student housing is housed or is administered through the Office of Student Life, and I'm not in Student Life, so I can't speak about the decision-making process that went for that. But I do know that that is an ongoing concern. Family housing altogether for our students is a concern. And while there is a lot of new housing that is coming up around the campus, that tends to be not designed for families or financially out of reach for families.
Yeah.
So we are having ongoing conversations. Our office has been talking with our colleagues in housing to try and find some solutions. We also, one of our programs, the Access Collaborative, has a partnership with Community Properties of Ohio. It's a management group that it's the management arm of Ohio Capital Corporation. And what CPO does is provide the Columbus Scholar House. It's a campus of 38 units, and they manage the properties, and those properties all come from with federal housing subsidies. And it's strictly for students who are enrolled full-time, pursuing an undergraduate degree. Students have to maintain full-time enrollment and they have to maintain GPA requirements. But our office, the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, provides wraparound services for those students. So the families live there. They have access to child care that's on-site, and we also have partnerships with other child care providers. And then we provide all of the programming and support for the students there. That's a wonderful model. We, in our office, we know student success strategies, and we have access to a whole array of community partners that can provide support services for those students. But we are not landlords. That's not what we know. That's not what we do. But this kind of partnership with CPO helps CPO do the thing that they know best, the management, and we marry that together with our expertise. And what we're finding is those students who are participating in that program are having 90%+ success in terms of retention and progress to graduation. So we need to look at more models like that that partner with those who are interested in developing the community and supporting the housing needs in the Columbus community with our educational aspirations. I think when we try to be landlords or try to spread ourselves too thin in that regard, that's not a viable solution. But we need to work together with our partners in this way.
I want to talk about that some more. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Yolanda Zepeda. She is Assistant Vice Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at Ohio State. And we're talking about how the demographic of the typical college student is changing. 1 in 5 students, at least 1 in 5, others have it at 1 in 4 students are parents. They are older. They are not necessarily 18 to 23 years old and from suburbia. They are coming from Appalachia. They're coming from centers of cities. They're coming with all different kinds of needs. And the question is, are they as valid as anybody else's in this changing climate? If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Roughly 1 in 5 college students in the U.S. is also a parent. That's 4 million people attending college, probably working while also tending to a family. That demographic falls into what's known as a non-traditional category, and that includes older students, veterans, first-generation college students, and immigrants. And their collective numbers have increased to a point that what's normal is probably changing. We're talking about how governments and institutions are responding to the changing demographics of the student population. Still with us is Yolanda Zepeda. She is Assistant Vice Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at Ohio State. Joining us is Jay Favuzzi. He is the Military and Veterans Affairs Manager at Columbus State Community College. Welcome.
Thank you, Ann.
And Lindsay Reichlin Cruz is the Study Director for the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Women's Policy Research. She joins us by Skype. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
Lindsay, you've studied parents who are students. Can you give us a thumbnail of the typical parent who is also a college student?
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of your conversation has really covered some of what these parents are experiencing while they're in school pretty well. We know that most student parents are older than the quote unquote traditional college student. They're in their late 20s or 30 and older. They are likely to have children who are childcare or preschool age, so under 5 or under 6, I should say. And they're also likely to be dealing with pretty extreme financial and time demands. So on the one hand, they are cash strapped. They have a lot of financial demands that can make it hard to afford things like childcare, which is pretty vital for their ability to be in school in the first place, but also things like tuition, books, and fees, leading them to need to work while they're in school. And that creates a lot of time pressure. Any parent spends countless hours providing care and just being with their children. When you're balancing that with college classes, studying, group projects, on top of often work hours, that doesn't leave a lot of time in the day. And I think that's part of how we think of the concept of affordability for student parents. It's not just financial. It's also, do they have the bandwidth to do this successfully and to reap the benefits of their college pursuit?
How does what's offered in college affect the decisions they make to go to college? I mean, imagine that they're probably not going for a degree in political science.
Well, some might be.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm generalizing, but I'm wondering if there's a trend on that score.
I think when you speak with student parents, what you hear is that they are incredibly motivated and dedicated to earning a college credential because of their children. They want to build a better life for their families. They want to set an example for their children that if they can do it, their kids can do it too. I think that motivation, that inspiration that their children provide is a huge driving force to push them despite all of these obstacles that are in their way. They don't nearly have, you know, the same amount of support that a traditional college student would receive while they're in school. And their kids really provide that motivation to help them press on.
I know you're study director for the Institute for Women's Policy Research, but do you know anything about the role of men as parents in universities and colleges?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly student fathers out there who are inspired by their children and struggling in many cases to make ends meet for their families while they're in college. Men in college, or I should say fathers in college, are more likely to be married than mothers. So mothers make up about 70% of all student parents, and fathers, and they're also disproportionately likely to be single. So you see a lot of single moms. When you're talking about fathers, you're often talking about two-parent households.
And that makes all the difference, right?
It can make a big difference. And it's, you know, again, I don't want to generalize. There are certainly single fathers out there. But having two incomes can be huge. Sometimes we hear about families where both parents are in college and they're both working, or one works while the other gets their degree, and then they switch off. So they're able to have a little more flexibility and just a little more support for the things that have to happen day to day for their kids and for themselves.
Another dynamic, of course, Jay Favuzzi, is the veteran piece of all of this. We have an increasing number of veterans because of the way the military is kind of churning them through the system. So, and by the way, there are a lot of women as well as men now. That's another big difference, right?
Yes, there sure is.
What are they? What do you think of as their challenges?
So, some of those challenges, you know, the transition, transitioning from military member to a college student
to civilian,
really being a civilian, and all those different pieces that come with it. You know, what am I going to do for income? You know, what am I going to do for health care? What am I going to do for, child care in some cases where, the military provided, all those different things for them. So, with our new students that we see, they do get a good transition brief when they leave the Department of Defense. But post military service, the follow-up isn't necessarily there. And, part of my office is to ensure that we're breaking those barriers down with transition to get them ready to, attend classes. And
what kind of barriers are we talking about? I mean, how do you break them down?
So sometimes, students have not even applied for their VA education benefits, which is, a separate process, and those are a majority of our questions that we get. How do I navigate that process? Where do I go to do that? After that, getting them, getting them into the college application pipeline and getting them ready to register for classes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what we think of as the non-traditional student who's becoming more and more typical on college campuses, whether it's at a place like Columbus State Community College, which is where Jay Favuzzi is the Military and Veterans Affairs Manager. Also with us, Lindsay Reichlin Cruz. She is the Study Director for the Institute for Women's Policy Research. That's a Washington, D.C. based think tank. And also with us, Yolanda Zepeda. She is the Assistant Vice Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at Ohio State. If you have a question or comment, an insight, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yolanda Zepeda, I wanted to ask you about something we were talking about before, and we were talking about housing and all of those kinds of issues. And given Ohio State's increased emphasis on the value of the community and with its sophomore requirement to live on campus, how does that translate to non-traditional students who can't afford to live on campus, who have children and there is nowhere to live on campus with them, or are married and that kind of a thing?
So one of the things that we do is really strive to make to create communities of support for the students and to make sure that those students feel that they're connected to a learning community that's outside of the classroom, but one that they can share their experiences with. So I mentioned before our Access Collaborative program, and we're doing that very actively. What is really wonderful about that program is they see other student parents who are sharing that whole array of challenges, and it really normalizes the college experience because they are all equally committed to earning their degree, and they have the same challenges, so they can share childcare when they need to do some stay late on campus. One can share the childcare responsibilities, but making sure that they don't feel they're the only ones. Putting them in for the traditional students who are on campus, the freshman and sophomore year, I think that that has a lot of benefits because it helps them connect their learning beyond the classroom. But we need to find alternate strategies. Another really key principle in the ways that we're serving non-traditional students of all sorts are providing flexible pathways to Ohio State, and then once they are at Ohio State, supporting them in that way. So one example is the James L. Moore Scholars Program. It's a fairly new program that supports students who are transferring from Columbus State.
Mm-hmm.
And we bring them in and we provide orientation that is different, that addresses more of the concerns that they have. And then we help to cultivate communities of support for those students. We also have it's a little bit different, but our Lewis Stokes Alliances for Minority Participation is a STEM-focused alliance. It's a statewide alliance, but our model is to pair our four-year institutions with community college students. And at Ohio State, we provide faculty-mentored research for Columbus State students while they're at Columbus State, so that they can start getting accustomed to being at Ohio State and have a easier transition, and then they're integrated in the community here. But I think community colleges are really key for the needs of non-traditional students.
They tend to be more accessible, mm-hmm. more night classes, all of that kind of
Absolutely.
A thing.
Absolutely.
Lindsay Reichlin-Cruz, NPR did an extensive piece on child care access means parents and school funding. It's a federal funding stream. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You were interviewed for the article and you called that funding stream a drop in the bucket. How so, and what is needed?
Yeah, so C-Campus, as it's called, mm-hmm. For short, is a really important program that is very unique. It's the only targeted source of funding from the federal government that supports low-income student parents' ability to afford childcare. It's an incredibly important program. It helps campus childcare centers, which are declining across the country, sustain themselves and support the students at their schools. But the need among the 4 million student parents out there is much greater than what this program can support. It was level funded at around 15 million for over a decade, and just recently received a big increase to 50 million. So we were incredibly excited to see funding for the program strengthened. But again, it's really just not doing enough. It's serving a fraction of our estimates of what is needed among student parents today.
How is it divvied up by client, or they get a percentage of whatever is out there? How does that work?
So it's a competitive grant program, okay. And institutions submit their applications to the Department of Education to receive a grant. And if they are successful, they receive a certain amount of funding, depending on their application, to help provide either free or low-cost childcare services at a campus child care center,
okay.
Or in some cases they can contract out with local providers to provide basically a subsidy for a slot for one of the student parents who are eligible.
Is that what you were talking about earlier,
yes.
Yolanda? Okay.
We received a grant last year. And as I said, we have funds and resources, and there are two challenges that we're facing. One is just making sure that we can reach the students and let them know that the resource is there. But the other is a lot of our child care providers have traditional days, structured days, and the life of a student, the child care
is
needs
drop in and drop out, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They need them at night, they need them on weekends, and so we're working on, we have some creative relationships that we're using the funds to support, but it's an ongoing challenge.
What about at Columbus State, Jay, is that a piece that helps veterans when it comes to, you know, getting through college there?
Yeah, that's a huge piece. Child care, you know, I'd say 50% of our veteran students have dependents, children, and, getting around, that whole child care question is a big deal. And we work with community partners. You know, my department and other departments will work with them to find, you know, child care if that's, you know, if that's an issue that comes up.
Let's see, Forrest in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Forrest.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
My concern when I was listening to the show is that I didn't hear anyone, and maybe I missed it, address the issue of time management. I know that sounds simple, but I have 40 years working in higher ed and every one of the type of institutions that's represented there. And what I've seen is that students overextend themselves. I would take students and sit them down and have them list out what their commitments were in a week. And I only take 5 days, and they would be overcommitted. So my question, and I'll leave it to the panel, how do you get to students before they get in the institution to understand that they committed themselves to time? It's not just money. Thanks, and I'll listen to your answer.
Thank you, Forrest. Yolanda Zepeda, I'll let you take a swat at that
one. Sure. Yes, time management is absolutely critical.
And we have talked about it on the program, by the way, Forrest, but go ahead.
And our students are actually quite savvy. I would say the student parents who are enrolled at Ohio State have overcome such great barriers to be there. They're the most determined and they're the savviest students. But with our Access Collaborative program, we provide weekly programming where the students come together and address all sorts of professional development issues. But one of them is time management and planning out not only their weeks, but also their time to degree. So they know exactly what they need to do and when. But I find that the students themselves are the best managers. I mean, they're the ones who are looking out for to make sure that they're not wasting.
It may be more the stereotypical student has a problem, but someone who's already juggling a family and a job and that kind of a thing. You know, Lindsay Reichlin-Cruz, given the different portals that a non-traditional student has, and let's particularly talk about married students and veterans as well that don't go through that traditional, route. I'm wondering, is there, you know, they can't join all the student groups. They're not on the dormitory, you know, council. They're not in a sorority or fraternity. They're not in a club because they don't have the time for it if they're good time managers. Is that a detriment to them going forward? Or can they put on their resume, raised a family and paid the mortgage while attending school full time?
Well, I certainly think they should put that on their resume, frankly, because I think it's a statement to their dedication and work ethic. But yeah, I think in some ways it's a detriment because it's part of the college experience that helps build your social network, which is critical, as we know, for finding a good job after college. It helps connect, you know, your interests, your academic interests to what you want to do professionally. There's a lot of benefits that I think come from those kind of quote unquote extracurricular activities that student parents often just don't have time for. So what I think is really important and what we've seen cropping up in some different colleges around the country are spaces on campus where parents can bring their children, they can do their homework. Maybe the parents are switching off babysitting, or maybe they have some interns, like there's what's called a family resource center at LA Valley College in California that does this, where it's just a place where the family can be, the student can be, and they can be together. So the panel talked earlier about the importance of having one's experience echoed either in the advertisements or among other students, and creating that family-friendly, welcoming space is really critical to make that possible.
And being able to see pictures of other people doing that tells
Absolutely.
That story to them. Is there any place like that at Columbus State, Jay?
We do have a veterans lounge there, which is always encouraged for, you know, family members and dependents to come and utilize. And really, that whole networking piece is extremely important. I know in the past, you know, some of our students have, you know, made new friends, and they've, you know, one student would watch, you know, another student's children, you know, to attend these networking events, which are so crucial to, you know, landing that next job or that next, you know, that next piece of your, you know, next piece of your life, really. So yes, that's there are open areas there that we promote and encourage that at the college.
We're going to continue our conversation. We're talking about non-traditional students, married students, parents who are students, first generation students, immigrants, you name it. there's a lot of non-traditional. In fact, there's so many now that it's not – it's really more of a norm. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about non-traditional college students, their struggles, and how the institutions they attend respond to their needs. Still with us is Yolanda Zepeda. She is Assistant Vice Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at Ohio State. Also by Skype, Lindsay Reichlin-Cruz. She is from the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And Jay Favuzzi. He is Military and Veterans Affairs Manager at Columbus State Community College. If you have a question or comment, if you're what is considered a non-traditional college student, give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you have a question or if you have a comment, some insights, you can email us as well at allsides@wosu.org. You know, we were talking off the air, Jay Favuzzi, and you said there's so many aspects to this transition from military to college. It can be very challenging. And I'm wondering, what about there are notably a lot more women in the military now than there were 20 years ago.
Sure.
It's completely different. So when you talk about veterans wanting to be around other veterans and that kind of a thing, is it working that way with men and women?
Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, in the military, it's a one team, one fight mentality. And, you know, just watching, watching our students bond together to get through that challenge of a chemistry class or, you know, a math class.
That becomes sort of their study group.
That's their study group. And we encourage them to, to come together. We offer a Coles 1100 class, which is a college experience class at Columbus State, and it's all veterans. And we encourage folks to take that that are transitioning to get those crucial time management skills, learn about various resources on campus and in the community, to make them a better successful student.
Is there something like that at Ohio State, Yolanda?
So Ohio State has a premier veterans center. I think Military Times named it among the best last year. The center provides a whole array of wraparound services, and there's a physical space where the veterans can come to. There's also a veteran house that offers some housing so they can live together and support a community in that regard.
Yeah. And Lindsay Reichlin-Cruz, is there enough of that out there for particularly female veterans?
Yeah. I mean, our work doesn't focus as much on the veteran population, but I think those types of supports are critical. And the more we think about the holistic needs of these students, the better.
The building the community thing is an important. Do women who are parents attending college, Lindsay, is there a piece there for building a community among them?
Absolutely. And I think it comes down to schools doing a little more work to help organize these students and give them opportunities to meet each other and provide, peer support and that networking piece, which we know is such a critical part of the college experience and really boosts, I think, students' ability to see themselves moving forward in their college career. So I think that's absolutely critical for these student parents and more opportunities for them to get together and just know that there are other parents on campus is really important.
Something that we haven't talked about, Jay Favuzzi, is what they bring to the table. So what, Yolanda Zepeda, what non-traditional students bring to the classroom, what veterans who are now getting their college education bring to the classroom. Jay, what about that? Are they kind of empowered in that regard?
Yeah, definitely. They bring leadership to a classroom and life experience you know, from their various travels in the military. And, you know, as an instructor, you know, I look toward that, too, and to look for those leaders that are going to, you know, bring out that, you know, bring out those values and teach the rest of the class as well at the same time.
Yeah. Are you finding that, Yolanda?
Yeah, they can ask questions and view the material from perspectives that aren't well represented. They're also, so Jay mentioned leadership. That's what I find many of the student parents themselves are leaders, and they serve as role models for and mentors to high school students. In fact, we have undergraduates who are mentoring high school students who are pregnant or parenting and encouraging those students and helping them in their trajectory to get to college. We also find our students going on to be very successful. So one of our Access Collaborative parents is serving on the a think tank that is supported by the Aspen Institute. So at a national level, mm-hmm. to provide insight and feedback and understanding about student parents in higher education. Mm-hmm. So our students are very highly engaged. They're just engaged in different ways. They're involved in different kinds of organizations, but they are giving back and contributing to the learning environment just as much as other students.
Yeah, we often talk, Lindsay Reichlin-Cruz, about what, you know, non-traditional students take from the system. They need extra this or extra that. What do they bring to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Yolanda said is very true, that student parents are mentors to each other and to other students on campus. Their time management skills, I think, are absolutely stellar and provide an example for other students who may not have to juggle so many responsibilities and therefore maybe aren't as good at it yet. And I think, like she said, bringing a new perspective to the work, lived experience, either professionally or personally, that can enrich the content that's being taught in the classes. I think that's absolutely important. And it's exciting to see models like competency-based education or prior learning assessments that are starting to recognize how we can bring in these kind of other lived experiences into the form of college credit to help these student parents and other non-traditional students progress to a credential.
We offer service learning opportunities for our students with children, where the parents and the children together go and do some project in the community, and that really teaches valuable lessons to the children as well. So another area that we're looking at is study abroad. So study abroad is really hard for students with children. So we're looking at some opportunities to do shorter abroad projects or programs or maybe day-long programs that would take them to a place that is accessible, where they could go and spend a whole day and really study a place as they would an experience abroad. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at those models because, again, they were developed for students without families. But we recognize that the hands-on learning, those high-impact kinds of learning experiences are really critical, and our students are asking for them as well.
Mm-hmm. Amel in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the Office of Diversity and Inclusion. I was an ag student, and I graduated in 2016 in the fall, and I'm a first-generation college student, so my parents were immigrants, didn't attend college, and I also became a mom in the middle of my college career. So I didn't even know about the Office of Inclusion until that fall semester that I graduated. I wouldn't really see them. I feel like you guys only reached out to certain communities in the Ohio State, like the arts and sciences. I never really saw anything in the ag emails about it. And I know a few parents that were in the ag. There was a few of us in the ag community. So I just wanted to know, I don't know if you guys reach out to more students now, all over campus, but that was a thing for me. And then I'm glad Buckeye Village closed, because I was not going to risk going into Buckeye Village. A thing we did was just reach out to job and family services and do low income housing. And,
what was wrong with Buckeye Village? You just didn't feel safe there? Or?
No, I heard there was a lot of problems with it, just roaches and just...
decrepit buildings. They are. Clean. They've been around a few. They've been around a few years. Right. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. Did I pronounce your name right?
Amel, yeah.
Amel. Well, thank you so much, Amel. I really appreciate it, and congratulations for graduating.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
Is that
thank
a familiar...
You. Yeah, thank you, Amel, for raising that. And I mentioned at the start of the show that, yeah, we are challenged with finding the students. We've done email blasts. I know that email is not really an effective way to communicate because we all receive so much email. One of the strategies that we're using is to reach out to diversity officers across all of the colleges on campus to make sure they have the information and they can work the channels that they have within their colleges. And also we are encouraging them to ask their faculty to put language in their syllabus that says these that there are resources and supports for student mm-hmm. parents. So I'm sorry that Amal didn't find out about our services until the fall of her last year, but we're working on that.
How familiar is that story, Lindsay Reichlin-Cruz, that mm-hmm. you know Amal said that she got pregnant while she was in college? Now, in the olden days, that meant you dropped out of college, but thankfully, that's not the case anymore, but how common is that?
Well, we don't have any data to know exactly how many people are having or giving birth while they're in school, but mm-hmm. I think it's much more common than people realize. And the fact that many parents stay in school and make it to graduation day and some leave is really a much more common occurrence than I think people think about. And I'd like to just talk briefly about the issue of identifying students on campus, student yeah. parents on campus. So we talk a lot about the need for better data on parents in higher education. We have national level data that allow us to say that there are about 4 million student parents, but institutions are not collecting this information regularly. And while obviously there are privacy concerns that we want to respect, knowing who on campus is raising a dependent child can empower that institution to both know what their outcomes are and what programs and policies might help them succeed, but also give them a tool to reach out proactively and say, we are here, we have some amazing supports like the Scholar House, like the Access Program that can help you and other peer and your peers who have children as well. So I think that's a conversation that we need to be having more broadly around the country on campuses and in states as well.
So, Jay Favuzzi, do you have enough data on who these people are and where they are?
We do a really good job of tracking tracking our veterans by type and benefits being used and even dependents as well of those veterans using the GI Bill, and I can speak on that. But that's important. We need to break that down and really take a look at who are we serving.
I would imagine, Yolanda, that in order to get the Child Care Access Means Parents in School funding, you had to have some data behind that.
That's right.
Proposal.
And it took us a couple of years of pushing to get just aggregate data. We know, as an institution, we know who the student parents are that are asking for student financial aid. They file their financial aid forms. But there are such limits on that data. So even for those of us who are managing the C Campus grant, we can't access that data. We can't get any individual names. What we do is send information out to the Office of Student Financial Aid, and they direct it to the students who would potentially be eligible. That's what we just need to saturate all of our messaging so that it's normalized that these serve that we expect students with parents to be on campus and they can easily find the information and the resources that are available to them. Hmm. That's really the only way.
Hmm. And then, Lindsay, funding, more money.
That would be great. Yes. like I said earlier, campus childcare has been declining across the country for over a decade now. This is particularly true at community colleges, but it's also true in the four-year space. And greater funding both for C Campus and for campus childcare more broadly is essential because not only are we providing care for the children of students that is going to help them persist and complete to graduation, but we are providing a learning ground for future early childhood providers as well as other students in other departments like nursing, dental health, mental health, et cetera. So these are kind of vital training grounds, both for the next generation of college students, for the next generation of social service providers, and programs like C Campus are really incredibly important, not only to help student parents succeed, but to build up these other goals as well.
Lindsay Reichlin-Cruz, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Lindsay Reichlin-Cruz is study director for the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and also Jay Fafuzzi, military and veterans affairs manager at Columbus State Community College. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
And Yolanda Zepeda is assistant vice provost for diversity and inclusion at Ohio State. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Ann.
And to everybody else, thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.